no one in Bangladesh or the Burma governments have actually asked the Rohingya refugees whether they want to go back.
Rohingya repatriation is on hold. It's Wednesday, November 21st. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. You'll find us as well on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, China's president makes a Philippines visit. Australia foils a terror plot. Electricity and oil refining come to two nations. Growing healthy kids, ancient sea monsters return. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Repatriation of some 2,000 Rohingya refugees was scheduled to begin last Thursday, but Bangladesh has now put the plans on hold until next year after failing to find any Rohingya willing to go back. Rohingya in the camps have told VOA that soldiers were stationed near the homes of those who were told they would be sent back last week, fueling fears of forced repatriation. Where does this leave the thousands of Rohingya refugees in camps in Bangladesh? That's what VOA Asia's Ira Melman asked Phil Robertson, Deputy Director of Human Rights Watch, who is based in Bangkok and spoke via Skype.
The Bangladesh government has now announced that they are not going to have any repatriations for the rest of this year, that they're going to wait until after the election, which is scheduled at the end of December in Bangladesh. And then they'll look at this again. The reality is they held a repatriation and no one wanted to go because, in fact, no one in Bangladesh or the Burma governments have actually asked the Rohingya refugees whether they want to go back. Nobody was discussing with them what are the terms that you would consider going back under. You know, and the Rohingya are quite clear that they want international protection. They want to have citizenship. They want to have freedom of movement. They want to be able to return to the areas where they originally came from. They want to have access to livelihoods and services. And what is on offer, as far as they can tell, is being sent to a transit camp and then finally an IDP camp that will probably be renamed as a village where they will, again, not be able to move around, not have access to livelihoods, and face systematic discrimination at the hands of the Burmese authorities.
So what's the way out here? Is there light at the end of the tunnel? What has to be done? And is there any movement to giving them some assurances that they might be safe?
Well, I think the next step is that Bangladesh and Burma are going to go back to the negotiating table in this bilateral discussions between the two sides. You know, they have very differing narratives. But the reality is, unless something changes on the ground, unless there is actually some political commitment by Burma to change what they are prepared to offer to the Rohingya to return, I think very few Rohingya will actually take up their offer. I think that ultimately we will see a situation where any movement back will be stalled. And that point, it becomes a question of how patient will Bangladesh be with all these people on their doorstep.
That is the next question. Is that patience running out?
Well, I think that there was certainly a desire by the Bangladesh government to show some movement in this issue before the election. They have certainly shown that they are prepared to send people back, that they have the logistic capacity and ability to send people back. The Burmese government has been claiming all along that the holdup in the repatriation is on the Bangladesh side, that the government has no efficiency in operations to be able to send people back. And quite clearly, Bangladesh disproved that by putting together the mechanisms for repatriation, even though no one showed up and even though Bangladesh correctly insisted that, you know, they would not send anybody back if it was involuntary. So this is going to be a discussion between the Bangladesh and Burma sides. Like, what are we going to do next? And you know, we don't know what sort of concessions the Burmese side may give. But I mean, ultimately, I think the international community needs to recognize that the problem really is on the Burmese side, that there is no protection for these people to go back. That's the biggest issue. And so they're not prepared to do so, and no one should force them to do so unless they get some guarantees from the Burmese side that things are going to be much better and much different for them.
Is there any other place or places Rohingya can go?
Well, I think that the Rohingya are going to start making some choices that are going to make people very uncomfortable in the region, which is getting on boats. You know, we expect that now we're in late November. This means that the typhoon season has really sort of calmed down. This is the traditional sailing season for the Rohingya boats. This is when we see the boats will push off from places in Burma and Bangladesh. So, you know, I think that we're going to start seeing Rohingya voting with their feet to leave the camps and try to get on boats and get out of this situation and try to go to places like Malaysia or Indonesia.
And what about the Rohingya who are still in Burma?
Well, they are really locked down in these internally displaced persons camps. They don't have access to leave these areas, to leave these villages. That means that they're basically restricted in what sort of livelihoods they can earn. The Burmese government is trying to insist that any sort of movement is dependent on them having national verification cards, which are the cards that require the Rohingya to self-identify as Bengali to get them. The Rohingya are opposed to that. So there's really a sort of standoff. And the reality now is that without access to health services, without access to education, without access to livelihoods, these Rohingya are completely dependent on the international community to support them. They're essentially putting them in fenced in concentration camps. You know, we're going to be dealing with a situation where these people are isolated. It's almost a quasi-apartheid-like.
Human Rights Watch warned in a report in August that the Bangladeshi government was restricting access to basic services by resisting attempts by aid agencies and Rohingya refugees to create any structures, infrastructure, or policies that suggest permanency. As a result, the report said, refugee children do not go to school, but rather to temporary learning centers where facilitators and not teachers preside over the classrooms. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now on voanews.com. Three men charged over alleged mass killing terror plot in Australia. Vietnam offers India a chance to get tougher against maritime rival China. Nissan says chairman arrested for financial misconduct in Japan. Hong Kong protest leaders warn of threat to civil rights. Where did North Korea's cyber army come from? You'll find these stories expanded with photos and videos and much more at Facebook at VOA Asia, as well as our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Chinese President Xi Jinping received a red carpet welcome as he arrived for a state visit in the Philippines, the first visit to the traditional U.S. ally by a Chinese head of state in 13 years. It followed a 2016 visit to China by President Rodrigo Duterte shortly after his election. Mr. Xi is expected to follow up with previous offers of $24 billion in development loans and other investments. But his arrival also generated protests outside the Chinese embassy in Manila to voice opposition to closer ties with Beijing. Stephen Rood is an independent analyst, fellow in residence at the Seoul weather stations in the Philippines, and visiting fellow at the Australian National University. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty the Xi visit comes as President Duterte has made often contradictory statements about the South China Sea, also known as the West Philippine Sea.
He most recently said that China was already in possession of it, and so that any military patrols were just making trouble. And that caused considerable consternation in the foreign policy community in Manila, because it seemed that the Philippines was giving away its claim to exclusive economic zone in other parts of the South China Sea. At the same time, there have been talks about joint exploration in the South China Sea, which is also very controversial because it would assume that they have equal rights, both countries have equal rights, when the UN tribunal has said that, in fact, China's claim has no merit. So there's considerable controversy about the South China Sea issues. On the other hand, there's a considerable eagerness on the part of the Philippine government for Chinese investments in terms of the so-called Belt and Road Initiative.
This visit comes after a rather controversial APEC summit that showed the divisions between the top Pacific powers, China and the United States. The U.S. warning Asian countries not to get involved in the, quote, debt trap that China is offering through its Belt and Road. Is the Philippines afraid that it might get involved in that debt trap?
There certainly are people who point to, for instance, the experience of Sri Lanka, where, in essence, the Chinese built and then took over a major port because of the problems in servicing the debt. And so one of the ways that people have tried to head this off is insist on more transparency in the terms, the interest rates, and conditions, and so on. That transparency has unfortunately not yet been forthcoming.
Is there a concern that getting deeper involved in Chinese economic activities will compromise the Philippine position on the South China Sea?
There's definitely a number of layers to that kind of concern. The first one is, of course, as you say, the direct bilateral disputes in the South China Sea. There is the general suspicion of China within the Philippine populace. It's the least trusted country. The fact of the matter is, though, that very few of those pledges have materialized in the last couple of years, so that sometimes one wonders if the worry is overblown.
Stephen Rood said while President Duterte remains personally popular in the Philippines, a majority of Filipinos oppose China's assertiveness in the South China Sea, and that may wear down Mr. Duterte's standing as the country approaches midterm elections. As for Manila's relations with Washington, Rood said it is the military and the Philippines bureaucracy, not Mr. Duterte, that are trying to maintain good ties with the U.S. Happening now in Asia, India's president has wrapped up a three-day visit to Vietnam for closed-door talks with his counterpart in Hanoi. Asia scholars say advances in relations between Vietnam and India will help both countries resist Chinese expansion in Asia, including the contested South China Sea. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad, as always, to have you with us today on VOA Asia. Thank you for joining us. Three men have been arrested on suspicion of plotting a mass-killing terror attack in Australia's second-biggest city, Melbourne. The men, aged between 21 and 30, were detained in counter-terrorism raids early Tuesday. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Investigators believe the three men had been inspired by the group calling itself Islamic State. The suspects are Australian nationals of Turkish descent and had been under surveillance since March. Police say the trio recently had their passports cancelled over fears they would travel overseas to engage in terrorism activities. Two of the men are brothers and all three have been charged with terrorist offences. Authorities assert that they'd become more energised in the past week to carry out an attack, and had their plots not been disrupted, the alleged consequences would have been chilling. More than 200 police officers were involved in the raids in Melbourne. Graham Ashton is Victoria State's Chief Police Commissioner.
There was a view towards a crowded place, a place where maximum people would be attending, to be able to kill a maximum amount of people as possible. I believe over more recent days, attempts have been made to source a .22 semi-automatic rifle to assist with the carrying out of that terrorism event.
A relative of one of the suspects denied they were violent nor inspired by radical Islam. The counter-terrorism raids came as thousands of people prepared to attend a state funeral for a restaurant owner who was stabbed by an Islamic State-inspired attacker in Melbourne on November 9. The suspect died after being shot by police. Earlier this month, three men were found guilty of conspiring to carry out a terror attack in Melbourne during Christmas festivities in 2016. Federal agencies say 90 people have been charged in connection with 40 counter-terrorism investigations across Australia since September 2014. The national terror threat level remains at probable. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Coming up, power is king and it's about to rule an island nation. You're listening to VOA Asia.
VOA Special English. a way to learn American English, and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
This news from VOA Asia. The U.S. Treasury Department has sanctioned a Russian-born South African citizen, alleging the man helped North Korea evade sanctions to purchase oil. Vladan Amchenstev reportedly helped North Korea obtain fuel oil and gas oil and worked with Singapore to front companies launder millions of dollars through the United States. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day to see and share top stories. As VOA Asia continues, power energizes an island nation, and China offers oil refining on today's VOA Asia business scene with Skylar Ogden.
Japan, Australia, and New Zealand will join the United States in funding a $1.7 billion plan to provide electricity and internet to much of Papua New Guinea. Experts say the agreement is intended to counter growing Chinese influence in the South Pacific, which is increasing because of the country's Belt and Road Initiative. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence.
We trust that this announcement today and the part of the United States of America in this joint announcement is proof that America and our businesses are investing in this region as never before.
Only about 20% of Papua New Guinea's 8 million people have electricity, and for many, the supply is not reliable. Under the new initiative, 70% of Papua New Guinea's population will have electricity by 2030. For decades, Australia has been the primary influencer among Pacific Island nations. China later began developing a host of bilateral financing agreements in the area, including plans to build a large hydropower generation plant in Papua New Guinea as part of its Belt and Road Initiative. The Prime Minister of Papua New Guinea has hailed this latest agreement.
This is a partnership of true regional economies, quite unlike the conventional model of development cooperation that we have had in the past.
The agreement was made Sunday at the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Meeting in the capital of Port Moresby. China's Hengyi Industries International is building a refinery and a petrochemical complex in Brunei's Muara Besar Island. The petrochemical plant is a major project of the Belt and Road Initiative. When finished, it will process 175,000 barrels of crude oil a day and produce other refined products like gasoline, jet fuel, and diesel. The plant is expected to create more than 10,000 jobs. As part of the initiative, the company has also developed a joint educational program training scores of petrochemical personnel in Brunei. Chen Lanchai is the CEO of Hengyi Industries.
With a scholarship from Hengyi, a group of sophomore students selected from Burma University will be able to study chemical engineering at Zhejiang University for 1.5 years.
When completed, the $3.4 billion complex will be Brunei's biggest foreign direct investment project. Construction on the plant is expected to be finished by the first quarter of 2019. For VOA's Business Scene, I'm Skylar Ogden.
This news from VOA Asia. Three men have been arrested on suspicion of plotting a mass-killing terror attack in Australia's second biggest city, Melbourne. Investigators believe the men, aged 21 and 30, had been inspired by the group calling itself Islamic State. The suspects had been under surveillance since March. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, most healthy children between the ages of 4 and 10 grow about 5 centimeters a year. So one family knew something was wrong when their son fit into the same clothes season after season. VOA's Carol Pearson reports doctors were able to get him growing once again after testing for a growth hormone.
All in on three, one, two, three, all in! 11-year-old Spencer Bayman is passionate about baseball.
My goal is to play college baseball.
There was only one problem. Spencer was the shortest player on his team.
I want to be as tall as these kids.
Go, Spencer!
Come on, Spencer!
Gradually, Spencer's parents suspected something was wrong.
It really set in 1 year coming out of winter into spring when he got out his cleats for spring baseball. And he put them on, they fit. And they never should have fit. Those were from the spring prior.
Spencer's parents set up an appointment with Dr. Bert Bachrach, the chief of pediatric endocrinology at University of Missouri Healthcare. After careful testing, Dr. Bachrach determined a growth hormone deficiency was causing Spencer's growth failure.
Growth hormone just doesn't affect your growth. It affects your muscle mass and fat distribution. So that affects your cholesterol. That affects your overall, it also affects your overall sense of well-being.
Growth hormone insufficiency is a disorder involving the pituitary gland, which is a small, pea-sized gland located at the base of the brain. It is this gland that produces human growth hormone, among others.
Ready?
Yeah.
Since Spencer started getting a daily hormone injection 2 years ago, he has grown about 15 centimeters. Still, he has a reminder written in each of his baseball caps.
It says HDMH, which means height doesn't measure heart.
And heart is something Spencer has plenty of. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
Some of you may be familiar with mythical sea monsters. For example, Scotland's infamous Loch Ness Nessie. But millions of years ago, there were actually real-life sea monsters that lived and thrived in what we now call the South Atlantic Ocean. And a Smithsonian Museum here in Washington is giving visitors a chance to learn about these ancient marine reptiles. VOA's Julie Tabo swims into the story.
As the continents of South America and Africa separated millions of years ago, scientists say a fantastic array of ferocious predators and other life forms colonized the newly formed body of water off the coast of Angola. Today, paleontologists are studying ancient fossils they excavated from the coastal cliffs of Angola as part of a collaborative project between Angolan, American, Portuguese, and Dutch researchers.
We knew that there were fossils there, we just didn't know how good they would be. This was a vast, unknown terrain, and we wanted to get there.
Lewis Jacobs is part of a team of scientists and students at Southern Methodist University that helped prepare the fossils for a special display at the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History in Washington.
In this exhibit, any visitors, kids or anyone else, can look and see and compare how the ecosystem and its animals of the Cretaceous of 72 million years ago are similar to ecosystems today.
Michael Paulson, senior research fellow at SMU, points out a few examples.
So this guy here is a little optimized fish eater, and you see the long, narrow snout, the interlocking teeth. This would be similar to what you would see in the ocean today in a dolphin, for instance. Here's another great example of the differences that you see between the animals in this ecosystem. This particular form is optimized to eating hard-shelled prey like large oysters, and that's what you see here in these very strange mushroom-shaped teeth. Within the same ecosystem, we have this great example of the top predator. This is Prognathodon chionda. You see the skeleton's about 25 feet long.
In addition to top predators like the monster-like mosasaur, the exhibit also includes fossils of gentler creatures and an ancient giant sea turtle.
We have a snapshot of this moment in time, 72 million years ago, that has preserved all of these animals that were living together in one place.
Scientists say that an asteroid wiped out most of those ancient animals millions of years ago. Julie Tabo, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. We'd love to hear from you. Send us a message. You can write to us by email. VOAAsia at voanews.com is our address. You can also message us on VOA Asia Facebook if you like. You can find us at voanews.com. Our current day's program, along with programs past, are all located on our program page at VOA Asia. And you can hear us on the radio. DZUP, 1602 AM radio at the University of the Philippines, Diliman in Quezon City, the Philippines. Thank you for everyone there who's tuned in today. And we thank our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Jonah Cummings, managing editor, Diane Gao. Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Have a nice day.